Production support for Earth Eats comes from Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio. Architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy-positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at GriffeyCreek.studio. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at PersonalFinancialServices.net.
We'll be able to harvest from them in like 50 years. So that's quite a few generations from now that we'll get to benefit from them.
From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, this is Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young. We've got quite a show for you this week. We visit the Bloomington Community Orchard for the planting of a nut grove. Josephine McRobbie has a story about a pop-up taco and tamale shop. Harvest Public Media tells us what's at stake in the glyphosate debate. And Chef D has a fresh idea for strawberries and rhubarb. All coming up after the news, so stay with us. Alex Chambers is back this week with news. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Kate. I've got a couple of stories today about agriculture and climate change. And if you like stories like this, don't worry. I'm pretty sure the next few decades will bring us plenty more. Early, heavy, and in places, relentless rains have led to a late planting season across much of the central United States, especially for corn. Iowa State University climate science professor Gene Tackle says the conditions that caused this spring's wet weather will continue as climate change warms oceans.
We have more moisture to deal with from the Gulf. We have a stronger jet that brings it into our area in this April, May, June period. And then our thunderstorms are just fueled with this extra moisture. So it's led to a very substantial increase in our precipitation.
Shannon Moeller with the Iowa Seed Association says some farmers who use cover crops can get back into their fields faster after it rains because the plant's living roots help the fields dry out. Researchers may have found a way to clean up cow burps. A recent study found that adding a particular species of red algae to cattle feed nearly eliminates the amount of methane they give off during digestion. Methane is about 30 times worse than carbon dioxide when it comes to heat-trapping effects in the atmosphere. The Australian research team showed that cattle feed with just 2% algae mixed in reduced methane burps by nearly 100%. Before algae feed additives can become standard industry practice, there are some big hurdles to overcome. The species known to reduce methane emissions only grows in tropical waters, and so far, it only comes from the wild. And the compound linked to methane reduction, bromoform, is classified as a probable human carcinogen. The amount used in cattle feed would be very low, but the link could hamper consumer enthusiasm. The other problem? The tropical algae could turn out to be a virulent invasive species if it's introduced in other parts of the world. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer for those stories.
Thank you, Alex.
Happy to do it, Kate.
Here in Bloomington, Indiana, we're lucky to have a community orchard. The Bloomington Community Orchard is an organization that maintains fruit-bearing trees and bushes on a plot of land next to a city park in Bloomington. The trees are planted and cared for by volunteers, and the fruit is freely available to anyone. The orchard is also involved in education programs, community plantings, and fruit tree giveaways. Last year, they partnered with the city of Bloomington to plant a nut tree grove on a piece of land between the YMCA and the Winslow Little League baseball fields, just a stone's throw away from the orchard's main site. It's a grassy, gentle slope just off of a jogging path and in view of an upscale subdivision to the east. They planted the grove in stages, with the third and final planting during Memorial Day weekend a couple of weeks ago. Earth Eats was on site for the first planting session on Earth Day in 2018. When I arrived, Ashley Thomas was mixing up some soil amendment packs for each tree.
Yeah, so we have a rock phosphate, we have pelletized gypsum, and green sand.
Ashley is the partner plantings manager for the community orchard, and she's organizing this planting event with a group of volunteers. The volunteers have been digging holes for the trees as instructed, and Ashley is now demonstrating how to get the trees planted.
You notice it's much wider than the tree itself. And like I was saying earlier, we want to perforate the sides so that the roots will also spread out. We also have these amendments already bagged out.
And then it's time to pull the tree from the pot and set it in the hole.
And just kind of gently loosen it. You don't want to tug too hard on it. So I kind of massage, like squeeze on the sides here until it loosens up. A good way to measure how deep you want it is taking this level to the ground. Now you can see the soil line is way lower than we want it to be.
With the new tree sitting in the middle of the hole, Ashley lays a shovel handle across the hole to show where the soil line will be once the hole is filled in. You don't want the soil to go above the line where it already has been when the tree was in the pot.
So we got the right depth. Take the tree back out, and we're going to spread these amendments all into the hole here. That way it really helps facilitate that root growth, nutrient intake, all of that. So we got it in the right depth. I'm just going to fill it in with soil here. It's a good idea to be filling it with water as you're filling it in with soil. These are great, thank you. Do a little bit more water. So I just kind of add a little bit more soil. And you do want to be generous with the water when you first plant it. It really is going to help set it up, get it really situated into the spot. You gently tamp it.
Next, Ashley dresses the top of the soil with a layer of compost. Then it's time for mulch. The volunteers mulch each tree with wood chips piled near the path.
But you want to make sure it's not right up against the tree, at least 6 inches out away from the base of the tree. And we do pretty wide, kind of like a donut. And you want to do about 4 or 6 inches tall. So it's a pretty good amount of mulch per tree. But you want to make sure there's a good distance between the mulch ring and the base of the tree itself. It's going to keep a lot of this grass from growing back in it, but it's also going to help retain some of the water in the soil. Does anybody have any questions?
Planting fruit trees always strikes me as a hopeful act. It's looking to the future. Not like when you plant something like zucchini or carrots. I mean, you have to wait a bit for the carrots to grow, but you'll harvest them that season. With a cherry tree, it's going to be a while before you're making cherry pie. Years. And with nut trees, it's an even longer wait. I spoke with Danny Onsaldo, who's been working with the orchard for years, and I asked her how long it would be before these trees would be producing.
You know, it's going to be a few years. Yeah. My hazelnut bushes, I think I started being able to gather the hazelnuts between 7 and 9 years. I can't remember exactly.
Why do you think it's important to plant trees like this that you're not really, maybe you won't be someone who's harvesting from them?
That's true. Yeah, we have a couple of those in the orchard too, the Korean pines in the orchard. They're probably going to be, we'll be able to harvest from them in like 50 years. So that's quite a few generations from now that we'll get to benefit from them. But I really think it's important for us to plant trees and just let our kids and our grandkids eat from them and learn from them. And, you know, they also just will offer a lot to the environment just with having something to soak up extra water and help with erosion and take up space where grass was going to grow so we don't have to mow as much.
I asked another community orchard volunteer, Josh David, how long he thought it would take for the trees to bear fruit, or in this case, nuts.
You know, I think what I know and still learning is that nut trees take a little bit longer than fruit trees typically. I think fruit trees, you can expect them to produce their first harvest in the first 5 years or so, whereas I think nut trees take maybe, you know, 7 to 10, sometimes even longer if they're a standard size tree, right? So dwarf trees and semi-dwarfs as just smaller trees overall will start producing sooner than standard trees, whereas most nut trees, especially these that we're planting today, are standard size, so they'll be bigger. So they may may take a little bit longer.
Why would you want to come out here and plant trees that you may not even be able to harvest from?
The idea is once they're in and they're producing, you know, they'll be producing for, you know, 50, 70 years. So, you know, the trees that we're planting today, we may never meet the people that will eat them, but we'll certainly, hopefully, they'll think back fondly on the people that came out here and sweated and got their hands in the soil today to make sure the community had a few more, you know, free access to local food. It's good for the community, it's good for all of us, you know. So the more people that know what they can grow around here, right? I think today we're planting hazelnuts and walnuts and pecans and almonds. And so just, you know, most people don't even necessarily think about those as things you can plant here, right? So part of it's just helping them appreciate what can be done and maybe what they can even do in their own yards and lives. Part of it's just appreciating the fact that the local government here wants to, you know, use public land to give back to the community educationally and in terms of the harvest. So we're just happy, you know, and honored to be a part of that.
The act of planting trees is hopeful and forward-thinking for some of the volunteers. But I asked 4-year-old volunteer Zahir what he was looking forward to. And it wasn't the harvest that might be 7 to 10 years away.
I just want to go home and eat some noodles, but my stomach is growling.
Some needs are just more pressing than others. Come to think of it, noodles sound pretty good right about now. Find out more about the Bloomington Community Orchard and how you can get involved on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Inc. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP & Associates, offer personalized financial plans and continued financial education matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And insurance agent Dan Williamson of Bill Resch Insurance, offering comprehensive auto, business, and home coverage in affiliation with Pekin Insurance. Beyond the expected. More at 812-336-6838. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. A great tamale or taco starts with great masa, the dough that forms tortillas and surrounds tamale fillings. Josephine McRobbie spoke with the business owners behind the Oaxaca-inspired restaurant, Ex Voto.
There's an educational component to everything that Angela Salamanca creates. First, there's Centro, her celebrated restaurant in downtown Raleigh, North Carolina.
So with Centro, it was, you know, cultural education about Mexico, what real Mexican food was.
Then the atmospheric bar, Gallo Pelon.
We wanted to bring mezcal to Raleigh and to North Carolina, and that also was about educating people about this really beautiful, very, very kind of like dark spirit.
And now there's Ex Voto, co-owned by her longtime collaborator, Marshall Davis. It's both a roving pop-up and part of an upcoming food hall. They make tacos and tamales, but they also bring science and cultural history to the forefront, focusing on the following.
So bringing the nixtamalization process and the honoring of corn as, you know, as an ingredient, as an offering.
Some recent foods at Ex Voto include fried cheese skirt tacos and a roasted carrot tamale that's inspired by carrot cake. Angela, who was raised in Colombia, and Marshall, a native North Carolinian, are eager to mix a reverence for tradition with an omnivorous sense of play.
We're not trying to do Guy Fieri, like, you know, tamale wontons or whatever, you know. And we're trying to have fun, but not distort it so far that it's kind of unrecognizable or that we're not really giving it justice.
Ex Voto purchases heirloom Mexican corn through a sustainable wholesaler. The kernels are then put through the traditional process of nixtamalization, cooking corn in hot water with calcium hydroxide.
And it just breaks down the hard outer hull of the kernel and allows the nutrition to kind of show itself and allows it to soften up enough for you to grind it. And so, you know, tortillas, the way that we do them, it's just corn and water. So the corn is softened enough to grind it, and as soon as it comes out of the grinder, it is dough.
This morning at Centro, Marshall and Chef Dallas Howard are doing recipe research and development for Ex Voto.
But today we're going to R&D some black bean tamales with a little mole.
Instead of grinding the nixtamalized corn by hand, which would be untenable for a thriving restaurant, they used the Molino, a hulking 2x3-foot commercial grinder. It was difficult to procure.
It takes about 3.5 month lead time, and it's very expensive. And then the machine shows up, no instruction book, no anything. It's just a machine that he made.
The Molino uses a huge amount of power, and they had to have an electrician visit to install it.
And the electrician wired it backwards the first time, so we were feeding the corn in it, and it was shooting the corn back out, and we were like, we didn't know we were doing something wrong, or he did something wrong.
Weaponizing corn isn't the only unique part of working with Ex Voto. The staff have also taken some pretty special field trips together. Angela had first visited Oaxaca, Mexico with her uncle before opening her first restaurant.
And I really, really loved everything about it, the food, the culture, the people. It felt to me a little bit different than Colombia because I was there as a true tourist with no, you know, like emotional baggage that you usually have from home. So I was really open to the experience.
Since then, she's brought members of her staff to visit the city and region to give them some grounded perspective on the history and culture of the local food. On a recent trip, they even did some cooking with the famed chef Pilar Cabrera.
So the way that the classes there is set up is you meet, you go over the menu, then you go to the market, you buy all the ingredients, and then you meet at her house. She has a huge kitchen, and then everybody kind of preps and cooks together, and then you sit down and eat a meal together.
They're inspired to bring this education and creativity to their home turf. Profit margins be damned.
We're driven by what we love, what we want to do. This is what we're going to spend 60 to 80 hours a week doing. And it's sure as heck. We're selling tacos, so you better love it. We're not selling filet mignon. Nobody's getting rich over here. So it's got to be a labor of love, and that's where it is.
Thanks to Josephine McRobbie for that story. When the pharmaceutical company Bayer bought Monsanto last year, it inherited the weed killer Roundup. It also inherited thousands of lawsuits claiming the chemical's active ingredient, glyphosate, can be linked to a form of cancer. But farmers have used more and more glyphosate over the last 20 years to keep weeds in check and have a lot riding on its future. For Harvest Public Media and the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, Christopher Waljasper explains what's at stake.
To understand how important glyphosate is to farmers, you have to go back to the 1970s, before Roundup was available.
We had a chemical that would kill grass, and we had a chemical that would kill broadleaf. For the most part, we try to kill most of the weeds by cultivation and that type of thing.
That's James Benham.
I'm state president for Indiana Farmers Union.
He's farmed in southeast Indiana for close to 50 years, growing tobacco, corn, soybeans, and now hemp. When Roundup came out in 1974, Benham says
it was a cure-all. I mean, you could kill anything with it.
So farmers spent less time, manpower, and fuel worrying about weeds and were able to implement no-till farming, which reduced soil erosion. Then, in 1996, Monsanto came out with bioengineered corn and soybean seeds that were tolerant to glyphosate, meaning farmers could spray Roundup throughout the year right onto the crop.
Now we're spraying as often as 3 or 4 times a year.
As farmers used more, weeds began to adapt resistance to Roundup. Sarah Ward studies weed resistance at Colorado State University. She says resistant weeds often catch farmers by surprise.
When you get the first herbicide resistance weed in your field, your reaction is probably just to think it's a skip. But okay, no, the sprayer didn't reach that one. Maybe next year you've got a growing patch and You know, you go back and typically the response is to hit it with a slightly higher dose. And within 3-4 years, you know, suddenly you've got a whole field of glyphosate-resistant palm amaranth, whatever, that you can't control.
Weeds have adapted resistance to herbicides before, but by then, glyphosate had replaced most other herbicides. In 2000, Monsanto's patent expired and other companies could sell glyphosate, so more was used. Weeds grew resistant, and the answer for many was even more glyphosate.
And most farmers look at it like, well, if they tell you use a pint to the acre or a quarter, I'll be a lot better.
Which is how farmers got to using an average of 40 times more glyphosate in the Midwest. The Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting analyzed more than 25 years worth of data from the U.S. Geological Society. They found that in some of the top corn and soybean producing states, that increase was even greater. In 1992, Nebraska corn farmers applied less than 1 pound of Roundup per every 100 acres. By 2016, they were putting on 129 pounds per 100 acres. In Iowa, soybean farmers increased their use of glyphosate by more than 6,000% between 1992 and 2016, while the number of soybean acres only increased by 15%. To be clear, it's not like every farmer back in 92 was spraying just a few ounces of Roundup on every field. It's that fewer farmers were using smaller amounts of glyphosate. But by 2016, the chemical was the most popular herbicide out there. In an emailed statement, Bayer spokeswoman Sharla Lord said, quote, "Herbicides are an outstanding tool for dealing with weeds, but they must be part of a larger strategy. Only a combination of various weed control methods can be successful in the long term." But some weed scientists think the industry is still moving in the wrong direction.
I think we are repeating old mistakes, frankly. But some of that is maybe desperation. It's the lack of alternatives at this point.
As Bayer deals with thousands of lawsuits over health concerns, all the companies that make glyphosate claim that it's safe. And the Environmental Protection Agency agrees. But in 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently said more studies are needed to determine the health risks in humans. So while weed resistance is what farmers are worrying about, it's the public opinion that makes glyphosate's future so uncertain.
They're the driving force for this to happen. I mean, we can continue to go down this road that we are with the chemicals and the way we're doing business, or we can reevaluate and come to some consensus on the value of food.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Christopher Waljasper.
This story was produced in collaboration with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Harvest Public Media covers our food system from the heartland. Find out more at harvestpublicmedia.org. And next we have a familiar flavor pairing, strawberries and rhubarb. But we're not making pie. This time we're using this classic duo in a salsa. Yep, you heard me right. While you wait on the peppers and tomatoes to ripen, try this fresh fruity salsa from Chef Daniel Orr.
So today, late spring, going into summertime, we still got some rhubarb out there, and it's the perfect time for salsa. Today we're gonna make a strawberry rhubarb salsa. Great with salmon, fatty fish, great with chicken, or you can just use it on your chips like a normal salsa. Now with rhubarb, you need to make sure you cut off the leaves. They are not edible for human beings, so cut those off and throw those in your compost. Next, we're going to dice that up, and I'm using this little tiny homegrown rhubarb from my mother's rhubarb patch. It makes it really easy because it's already pretty much cut up. And you can just dice it, and we're going to leave it raw. A lot of people don't think of eating rhubarb raw, but it's really sour. It's got that sweet tart kind of flavor to it. Throw those in our bowl. And then we're going to add some minced onions. Now with salsas, you want pretty much everything cut the same size. Gonna use that rhubarb as our guideline to how big we cut everything else. Next we got some strawberries. You can get those real nice sweet summer strawberries. And we'll do a couple more. Then we got some jalapeno. We're gonna add a little bit of tomato. But we want the rhubarb and the strawberry to be the stars in this performance. The Italians like to serve balsamic vinegar and a little cracked black pepper with their strawberries. So this isn't completely off the wall. I'm going to mince up that about a half a jalapeno. And as with all chilies, the spiciest part is that white membrane that holds the seeds in the center of the pepper. So if you're really not into having a spicy dish, you can cut that white membrane off. I'm going to add one tomato.
I spotted a few vendors with tomatoes already last week at the farmers market. But if they aren't ready in your area yet, you might want to use a handful of those nice, sweet cherry tomatoes you can find in the supermarket.
A few scallions to finish this off, as well as some cilantro. We have about 4 scallions, probably a quarter cup of chopped cilantro. Finish it off with the seasonings, pinch of garlic, a couple tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, juice, 2 limes, and then finally some salt and pepper. About a teaspoon of each. We'll put a little pinch of cayenne. Give that a toss. Gonna serve this over a little chicken breast. And that is our strawberry and rhubarb salsa with grilled free-range chicken breast.
We've got photos of this bright presentation plus the recipe at eartheats.org. We also have recipes for more traditional preparations of strawberry and rhubarb. Again, you can find us at eartheats.org. If you liked what you heard today, tell a friend or subscribe to our podcast. You can leave us a review on iTunes. It really helps others find us. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Josephine McRobbie, Daniel Orr, Renee Reed, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Angela Salamanca, Marshall Davis, Chef Howard, Ashley Thomas, Danny Ansaldo, Josh David, Zahir, and everyone at the Bloomington Community Orchard. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at griffeycreek.studio. Charles Schwab & Company, Inc., independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP and Associates, offer personalized financial plans and continued financial education matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And insurance agent Dan Williamson of Bill Resch Insurance, offering comprehensive auto, business, and home coverage in affiliation with Pekin Insurance. Beyond the expected. More at 812-336-6838.